This is CliffCentral.com.
Claire Bissaker is the author of On the Brink, which is a terrific book. It pretty much is comprehensive in terms of its analysis of our current economic situation, the current situation with regard to who is in charge of that economy. And the book was only launched last night, so congratulations, Claire.
Thanks so much, Gareth.
How has it been received so far?
I've had a lot of really positive feedback.
Right.
And BC Jonas was the discussant last night.
Right.
At the launch, and was extremely generous in his feedback on the book. So it's going well. It's selling well. And it's at number 11 at Exclusive Books on the bestsellers list, which is a big surprise for an economics book.
No, that's
for me
terrific.
Anyway, it's a big surprise.
You know, I was saying to you just a moment ago when we met for the first time that this really is a tour de force in some ways, because there are so many questions and there's so many confusing aspects to our economy at the moment that any amount of academic or an analytical nature – Any amount of analytical or academic material on our economy at the moment would be gold. We don't have the data capturing that we might have had under previous finance ministers. We don't have a means of interpreting that data in the way that many of our previous finance ministers and Treasury in general and SARS and all the other important constituent parts of the economy used to take these things in. And so much of it is now political that for the economist, it can be kind of frustrating a lot of the time, because we know what the fundamentals need to be. We've been told over and over again by people who are luminaries, people who've had the experience, people who've been involved both in policy and in practice with our economy, what we need to do. But no one is writing new stuff. And we're looking at an economy that isn't growing. We're looking at retraction in many cases. It's kind of terrifying. So for the average person, this represents a huge gap in knowledge that people like you, thank God, are there to fill. Do you feel that's a responsibility, or was that not part of the agenda?
It wasn't the initial agenda, but it became the agenda pretty quickly. So the initial agenda was to write a book on the fiscal cliff. Are we going over the fiscal cliff? Because at the time it was sort of the buzzword, and it was sexy, and it seemed like the book that the publishers wanted.
Who started saying that? Who was the
first
person?
It's an American term, and it applies to their debt ceiling. We don't have a debt ceiling, so it means something slightly different here. So it's a very informal term. It means different things to different people.
Basically going over the edge.
It means, for us, it would probably mean going to the IMF for a bailout. I think that was what most people would think would be the kind of, you know, the end. It's the worst possible outcome. You've lost it. You can't afford to pay salaries. You've got to go for help. That would be for sure going over the fiscal cliff. But we can come back to that.
Mm.
But just to answer your question, I wrote the book because I love writing about economics, and I'm particularly interested in the fiscal story.
Mm-hmm.
But I started writing straight after Nennegate, thinking I was going to write a simple, lean book on fiscal policy. And I very quickly realized I had a ringside seat to the most gripping political thriller of the last 20 years. And I was completely engrossed by the story. And I was writing it anyway for the FM, which is my full-time job. So the book was really a part-time project on the side. So as I was writing the cover stories and the weekly features for the FM, and I had this fantastic material, and I realized this is a bloody good story.
Mm.
And the fiscal stuff is now the backdrop to a meaty thriller type.
Yeah,
type
it's a
story.
Political drama.
Yeah. So then I got angry. I got really angry at the assault on the Treasury, and I became frustrated by the lack of rationality in the economic debate. The pseudoscience, the conspiracy theories, these cooked up stories about Treasury obstructing transformation by withholding funds from the economy. All the excuses that were put out to get rid of people like Nene and Pravin and then Sabisi Jonas.
Well, it's ironic. Tonight I'm actually going to see Nhlanhla Nene speak at a dinner. And I haven't met him before. I always thought that he was a very capable man by all, you know, most of the sort of learned people in economics around me. They seem to regard him quite highly. But this is this was the beginning for a lot of people of the end of a lot of things, and the end of the beginning for a lot of things to some others. Nennegate was the moment where the president just went too far. and where everybody said, whoa, hold the hell on. We've heard lots of stories about what actually happened at that time, who it was who had those emergency meetings with him in those 2 or 3 days of chaos after Ntlantlanene was fired. Do we know any more about how it actually unfolded? Have you discovered any more? Because as you say, it's the meatiest story and that's the genesis of it.
Sure. So I went and sat with Nene for a couple of hours, and what struck me most is how he has no bitterness over this and no even anger directed at the president. My conclusion was that he's such a straight arrow that he could not even blame the president for firing him. He took it as a kind of a career decision, and he was happy to do what needed to be done. This president had said to him face to face, thank you for your service. And Mr. Nene said, thank you for letting me serve. And it was this polite end to his career. He believed that this BRICS bank job was genuine. The perception in the public and the story that has gone around in the media and has become now has the force of fact is that he must have drawn the line very clearly in the sand and said to the president, I will not fund nuclear, or I will not bail out SAA. And that has now become common cause. Everybody writes that Nene was fired for drawing the line on SAA and nuclear. He says, no, not at all. He said, I'd had no special discussions with the president. It wasn't about nuclear and it wasn't about SAA. Yeah. It was about everything. We drew the line as Treasury on everything and nobody was happy. None of my colleagues in cabinet were happy because we were starting not to fund things. We were starting to delay projects. We were drawing that line around public finances, saying we have to tighten our belts.
So it by no means was a question of naivety on his part, because when you started explaining how it all happened, I got this pang, this feeling of a very awkward feeling of, oh, hang on, this guy actually, he was just an apparatchik. But he doesn't seem to be that. In fact, what you concluded with was that there were so many things going on that they didn't even make it turn on one point. It was about the entire state of the economy and the entire arrangement of state capture.
So Nene was doing his job as finance minister, but he was not getting the support he needed from his cabinet colleagues or the president in making those important fiscal decisions that needed to be made. And that was that sort of fed into that whole myth about Treasury being too powerful. That unhappiness that you get in the rest of cabinet when they start to point fingers at the Treasury and they deny collective responsibility for decisions they've made as cabinet, budget decisions.
Is the president so Machiavellian that he manifested that, or was it just a question of him being an opportunist, the president now, and seeing that this was happening and exploiting that for itself?
So it started even under Manuel, because you had this resentment about Trevor Manuel being this economic czar with powers of a prime minister.
Well, he controlled the purse strings.
But it was in his case, he had the backing of the president, which made him a very powerful figure. In Nene's case, there was no backing. But that sort of myth of the finance minister having these powers that were unique to the Treasury, which gave the Treasury the sort of carve out special status, had caused resentment for a long time. And so, as you say, it was exploited by the president. It's not factually correct, but it was exploited because it suited the agenda at the time, the whole state capture agenda. It played in beautifully. And you see in the book, I talk about Project Spiderweb, which was that fake intelligence report. We assume it was fake. It was never really discussed. You know, it was never proven where it came from, but it was a very flimsy document. But it accused Treasury of being enthralled to a Stellenbosch mafia.
Yeah.
They were
the
all
white monopoly
on
capital
the play.
Crew, yeah.
You know, so that white monopoly capital argument was 4 months before Nenegate. That Project Spiderweb document suddenly appeared everywhere.
Which we now know was also proffered and executed by the likes of the Bell Pottingers.
So there's exactly the same pattern then happened with Gordon. Suddenly there's a fake intelligence report that surfaces while he's in London. He's presumably, this report says he's enthralled to foreign forces. He's selling the country. And within a week, he is fired along with Jonas. So it's that whole state capture pattern. We've seen it in, you know, institution after institution.
There are very, very smart people in Treasury. It wasn't just the finance minister. And we always tend in this country to look right to the top and we don't see all the engines that are working so hard underneath. How damaged is Treasury since that move?
So it's
how many brilliant people have they lost?
They haven't. They've hardly lost anybody, but I imagine we will start to see some attrition if there's not a big shift in December. The ANC elective conference will be key.
Well, I mean, we know SARS had major attrition.
They
after
had
Tom Moyane
massive
was
attrition. So we're looking at about 50 top people leaving SARS. The only people that I know that have left Treasury are is Andrew Donaldson, who had already started to move out even before Pravin was fired. He started to take a sort of back seat. And, of course, the DG, Lungisa Fuzile, who left 5 weeks after Gigaba came in.
He was quite complimentary about Gigaba, I read in your book.
He's astonishingly complimentary. If we spoke to him now, there might be a slight difference in his message.
When you quote him in your book, you said that he was impressed by him and said that this guy had a very good brain, that he learned some very complicated economic concepts in an incredibly short space of time, and that they had faith when he took off on that trip to America that he would do a very good job of attracting foreign investment and of placating the concerns of people who thought that this country was on a one-way ticket to hell.
So that was a very interesting interview for me, sitting with Lungisa discussing his first impressions of Gigaba, because they really were first impressions. It was a matter of weeks. And at the time when I wrote that, it was probably around about May. It was early days, May, yeah. So there was still, the jury was still very much out on Gigaba. Mm. It was before the Gupta Leaks emails came out. So his role and, you know, his culpability was still very murky. When the leaks finally came out, one of the very first people to be pinpointed was Gigaba. So sentiment has been changing ever since, and his conduct hasn't been particularly inspiring. So I think that sentiment against Gigaba has now shifted quite strongly from Fuzile's initial impressions, which were very favorable. And I think we're now treating Gigaba with a fair degree of skepticism.
You did interview a lot of people. I mean, you spoke to Nhlanhla Nene as well, and Kabisi Jonas, and then you've got Pravin Gordhan in there too. I mean, there's a certain kind of person who has to end up running who has to be the FD of the country. There's a certain sort of personality that has to come into play when you assume a role like that. Trevor Manuel, in many ways, fitted that mold. You need a serious-minded person, not necessarily a serious person, but a serious-minded person who's extraordinarily honest, direct, straight. They balance the books. They try to figure out if things are not working, why they're not working. They're analytical. They're not small talkers. You can't have an interview with these people and talk nonsense to them. It's not going to go anywhere, right?
Sure. So one of the questions I asked Lungisa was there a common thread between, he was the DG for Manuel, for Nene, and for Pravin, and in fact for Gigaba. So he had served under all these ministers, and I asked him if there was a common thread between Manuel and Pravin and Nene, and he said there was. And one thing was that they were all extremely hardworking. The other thing was that they all welcomed open debate. And the most important thing was that they were all constitutionalists. They lived and died by what the Constitution said. And after that, they stuck by the laws that governed public money and the use of public money. So they were all of the same ilk in that sense. I think that might be what you're driving at, apart from their intellect, which is very obvious if you've ever seen them speak.
Yeah, not unintelligent by any means, any of these people. Is Gigaba smart?
Clearly. It's the one common adjective that is used to describe Gigaba across all the media. And he is clearly very sharp, which means there's potential for him to be a great finance minister. And I think there was a hope that he could actually grow into the role. And Lungisa says that I thought there was no reason why he couldn't grow into this role in time and make a success of it. And that's where the initial optimism
but
came
isn't
from.
Isn't that also what you'd expect a bureaucrat to say?
No, not in a private interview. Lungisa was, of course, out by then. So he was no longer employed. So this was coming from his personal view. So that was very encouraging. We know Gigaba is a smart guy. Mm. But, of course, it's not enough to be smart to get the economy to grow and to generate confidence. And his role now, Gigaba's role, is to restore confidence in his leadership and in the economy in order to get private investment growing and the economy growing. And I'm afraid he doesn't have that. He doesn't have the credibility to restore confidence in the economy, and he's not getting it by the day. The longer he takes to turn Eskom around, the longer he takes to do the right thing at SAA, doesn't wash.
You bring these parastatals up. How badly have they hit the economy? I mean, what kind of damage has been done to South Africa's GDP and to our financial image in the eyes of investors and people who are interested in this kind of thing in the world? How badly have these parastatals done us an injustice?
Sure, it's a good way of asking the question, because you've made a distinction between the financial cost and the reputational cost. Mm. And the reputational damage might even be greater. On the economic cost, probably the worst thing we could have done as a country to our economy was allowing Eskom to load shed, to get itself into a situation where it couldn't provide the energy the economy needed. And if you had to put a cost on load shedding, and economists did at the time, it ran into billions. And not only was it a lack of supply of electricity, it was the price increases, 20% a year for several years in a row.
I ask people who understand these things, and you're chief among them, this question over and over again. I've yet to find a satisfactory answer, or at least one that can assuage my confusion over it. This is a company that provides something which everybody needs. It provides it at a cost which is always increasing, but it provides less and less of it to us, and then discourages us from using its product, and then runs into billions in debt. How is this even possible? How horribly must you mismanage something? I mean, surely anyone with two eyes, two ears, and two hands, anyone on earth, can see that this is a machine that works on its own. It doesn't need a lot of – you just need to keep on building power stations when you start seeing the supply is running down and the demand is going up. It's not complicated. How can this have been mismanaged so badly?
But it's the same story in every parastatal, nearly every parastatal. It's exactly the same story of complete and utter mismanagement. And the good thing about what the point you make is how quickly it could then be turned around. Because if it's inherently a profitable enterprise, you put the right people in, you should be able to actually...
Some of them are monopolies.
They are all monopolies. They're all 100% monopolies. So with the right management, you should be able to actually change Eskom pretty quickly.
So is it a new level of stupid when it comes to management? I mean, must we be crass and call it a complete incompetence of the highest order? Or is it much more nefarious? Is it much more about trying to obfuscate and confuse and cloud so that there can be pillaging behind the scenes?
That's definitely both.
Both?
Mm.
We know from is that how they've been caught out? You know, if they'd done the second part of my question better, they wouldn't have been caught. If they'd done the first part better, they would have stripped the thing out, and we would never have known.
Well, look, Brian Molefe was doing quite a good job of managing Eskom. We know that under Molefe, things started to improve dramatically from a business management point of view. So he was a smart guy, and he was a good CEO, and he was turning Eskom around quite obviously on the figures. But of course,
we didn't know who his real bosses were.
So he was not stupid, and he was not the sort of hopeless hack that we're talking about.
He was just criminal.
He was just according to the public protector's report, he had a case to answer, which he has not yet answered. His career is over. The career of Ben Ngubane is over. We see in the SABC
Ngubane had a hand in that as well.
He's all over the
Ben
place.
Ben Ngubane's everything that he's touched has turned to shit.
Yeah.
And this is what we're dealing with.
It's exactly what we're dealing with.
All right, so let's get away from the parastatals, just in case we get too depressed to continue the rest of the conversation. Because what you've done is you've told the story of South Africa on this fiscal cliffhanger, but you've also brought in your extraordinary experience and knowledge in reporting for the Financial Mail for how many years as their economics editor into how the fundamentals do or do not apply in South Africa and where they have been made to apply properly and where it's worked, and then how things like the NDP have just run aground. And I mean, there's a quote from Trevor Manuel in there too about how disappointed he has been in how all of these really well thought through plans that he put such an enormous amount of effort into have all just gone to nothing.
Sure. So, you know, that is one of our major failings as a country, is that we've got the highest unemployment rate, or one of the highest unemployment rates in the world, and we don't have a job strategy. We don't have a growth plan.
No.
We have something called the NDP, which hasn't been implemented for 5 years. We developed three growth policies in 3 years, between 2009 and 2012. We didn't implement any of them, and they were contradictory. So, you know, we wonder why our economy has shrunk, or not shrunk, but slowed. Growth has slowed every year for the last 5 years.
I hear people saying, well, it's a symptom of how the world is working, but that's just not true. Other developing economies are all outperforming us, even ones that have completely fallen on their backsides, like Brazil.
Sure.
And in Africa, there are countries just north of our border who are growing at 6% or more.
Sure.
So there is no excuse. It's not a geographical problem for us. It's not a third world or developing economy problem for us. The world's economy seems to be quite supportive of the sort of thing that's going on here. It should be working.
Yes. So that is exactly why I wrote the book, because as an economics writer, I really wanted to understand why an economy with as much potential as ours had underperformed so poorly. That was personally one of the reasons for writing the book, was to really unpack these reasons. And each chapter in the book is another reason why we've underperformed so poorly. And, the lack of a growth policy is one. Mm-hmm. Those six binding constraints that Esquisa pointed out in 2006, 10 years ago, it said these are the binding constraints to growth. It was the clearest economic policy we've ever had. All we had to do was relieve the binding constraints. They are more binding now than they were 10 years ago. We've learned nothing new about the economic constraints facing our economy in the past 10 years, and we have not addressed them.
You could even argue that there's been more regulation introduced.
There's been regulation in all the, you know, in all the wrong places, but we haven't done the absolute basics that we said we would do. So government's been spinning along.
Again,
we're applying the NDP, but it's spin. It's
again, we must introduce the same question that I asked about the parastatals. I'm sorry if this is traumatic for you, but the first question is, are these people just grossly incompetent? And the second question is it not necessarily incompetence, but mismanagement with a purpose of redirecting funds in nefarious ways?
So the answer on economic management is comes down to lack of political will. There has been no political will to implement the NDP, because you have a president who doesn't crack the whip at the top. So you've got ministers of different cabinet ministers. You've got one rowing upstream. You've got the other one rowing downstream. You've got some going down little tributaries on the side. There is no cohesive strategy within government. You have the visa debacle, which is a really clear example, tightening up visa restrictions, and you've got the tourism minister begging him to change his visa, the Home Affairs Minister, to change the visa regulation.
Which at that time was Malusi Gigaba.
Which happened to be Malusi Gigaba, and you asked me how smart he was. And I say very smart, but not smart
demonstrably
enough
not so
to
when,
realize yeah. what his visa regulations were doing. And it took him about a year to even admit that maybe this wasn't the best way to grow an economy.
All right. I want to go back to something that you brought up just now. When we look at the National Development Plan and all of these ideas that everybody had, because there were people with good ideas and a while ago now, but there were people with good ideas. Now, are any of these congruent with what you have studied for years, what you've been paying attention to in terms of the economics? I mean, are you a free market capitalist? What sort of ideological basis do you, are you entirely analytical, or is there some bent that you have that you've learned in all of this that to you proves that there's a better way to do things than others?
It's a good question. I'd say I'm a free market capitalist, but I'm also a pragmatist, and I don't have an ideological attachment to something because it fits with my worldview. So I believe that the free market fails. I believe that there's a role for business to be activist and to do things that will compensate for free market failures. I don't believe that the free market is going to solve our problems. I don't think trickle-down is going to work at all in South Africa, and it hasn't worked. If I was a rabid free marketeer, I wouldn't believe that. I would say trickle-down will solve all our problems. And the book points out manifestly that that is not going to happen. We can't have growth without transformation. And I think that it's explained in a very analytical way by looking at one of the most shocking figures in the book is that we suffer from perfect wealth inequality. 10% of our population owns 95% of the wealth. When you combine that fact with the fact that we have structural unemployment, what that means is that even when our economy grew at 5% each year for 5 years, unemployment never dipped below 20%. So even when the economy grows, the most marginalized and lowest skilled people don't get jobs.
How do we fix that?
You can't fix it through growth.
Okay, but then so what is a better instrument?
It means that you're going to have some institutionalized system of redress for generations, and for the people who are unemployable, it means social grants, it means welfare, it means public works programs, it means some form of government intervention, because structural unemployment nowhere has ever been self-correcting. And when you add in another important fact, which comes out in the book, that is the problem of the working poor. Half of the people who've got jobs earn too little to break out of poverty. So even if you increase employment, say you halve unemployment, you don't halve poverty. So if you take all these things together, it means simply accelerating the growth rate will not solve our inequality problem. Our inherited patterns of wealth will be reinforced as we grow. Okay,
you need state intervention.
You need a system of dealing specifically with education. It really comes down to education as unlocking those opportunities. So at the moment,
but do we, a state that can't even manage the parts of things that, let's say the things that they have complete control over, the state-owned enterprises, a state that cannot manage those things, surely we can't advocate for that state, incompetent as it is, clearly as clearly it is at managing all the things that it's meant to manage, to allow them to be the interventionist state and give them even more power to then try to bring people out of poverty or create opportunities for unemployable people. That this is like asking Croesus to stop spending.
So you're absolutely right. So the if you had to say to me what are one of our top priorities as a country, it's got to be fixing the state, because everything else flows from a state that is capable and can just get the basics right. So just to
and the state does employ tons of unemployable people. we have an egregious, obviously fecund state. There's such a huge number of such a proportion of our population employed by the government in jobs that we don't need them for.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is part of the reason we're in trouble too. Our spending is sky high and our efficiency is low.
Quite so. So the argument on the transformation story is that we have really stuffed up on our transformation policies. We've got to reorientate transformation to incentivize job creation, incentivize production of new enterprises. So we've got to reorientate BEE so that it creates more power at the bottom for a second,
because what you're also getting to here, I think, is that we need to stimulate small businesses and we need to stimulate entrepreneurship and enterprise at that level. But let's start with BEE. Obviously, another disaster zone.
Yeah. So government is obviously realizing this, and it's talked about this black enterprise project that it has. We've got to have new black businesses. But really what we need to be doing is making the business environment more enabling for the small business guy. It was one of the SGISA shortcomings. It said, reduce the burden on small businesses.
Yeah, but we've got this minister, Lindiwe Zulu, who's supposed to be looking after this stuff. What has she done?
I have no idea. As far as I can see, she has done zero.
What's her mandate?
Her mandate is to look after small businesses and make them more dynamic. There's research in the book on small businesses that says that they are becoming less and less dynamic. But only about 20% of all jobs are now found in small businesses. That in fact, big businesses are becoming better at creating jobs than small businesses, which is a nightmare if you think that we have this expectation that small businesses are going to create 90% of the jobs in the economy.
Mm-mm.
Small businesses are failing, and the whole sector is becoming less and less important in the economy. So, you know, that's just another one of those areas where we've done nothing. We've just allowed time to pass and allowed the economy to just drift, left, you know, just neglected it since the global financial crisis. And you see it in the numbers slowing year after year after year. The conclusion in the book is this administration will not be able to solve our economic problems. The public has lost complete confidence in the Zuma administration's ability to get the economy growing. Confidence is at rock bottom. We will not see any improvement in our economy as long as there is no confidence in the leadership. So we need wholesale leadership renewal. And only once we've got that right can we talk about fixing the state, fixing the education system, and all these other things that have to happen. And they're not even rocket science. Mm-mm. You know, the NDP is an interesting document because there's a perception that it is a wish list. It's uncosted. There are 500 pages. There are 15 chapters. It can't be implemented. In fact, half the NDP is devoted to fixing accountability of the state, fixing the capacity of the state, ending cadre deployment, ensuring that appointments in the education system are merit-based, devolving accountability to the school principal so that the school is therefore run properly. It's about lines of accountability that we don't have. So it's not rocket science. It's not about implementing magical new innovative economic policies. It's not about reinventing the wheel. We know what works. We know the six binding constraints. We know they haven't changed. We know we've never addressed them. We've got to actually start doing some of the stuff that we've talked about for years and years. A program of execution is essential, and you cannot get away from that. But that requires leadership, and leadership that can land the program throughout society.
Well, I was amazed at you managed to rope in Judge Dennis Davis as your he wrote the foreword,
yeah.
a very eloquent and beautifully crafted foreword for a book that is as beautifully crafted and put together, and then a chapter on state capture by the editor of the Financial Mail, Rob Rose.
That's right.
This state capture thing has become pedestrian talk now. So everybody is aware of it. Everybody knows what's going on. It has a name. But are we getting anywhere with dismantling it? I mean, I don't see anything happening. In fact, now the Treasury is also a lot closer to the levers of power that the Guptas exercise and that the president and his son seem to exercise occasionally. Are we any closer to dismantling this ugliness?
It's the million-dollar question. And I think the kind of rage being meted out on KPMG and Val Pottinger is partly a reflection of our frustration at being unable to nail the big guys and the big fish. So we're taking it out on the soft targets, and they deserve it. But we actually should be nailing all the miscreants who we know. Because we have the Gupta leaks, we have expose after expose.
The difference between KPMG with respect and the bureaucrat who works in the Department of Finance, for example, who's corrupt, is that the guy who works in the Department of Finance works for us.
Sure.
We're paying for him.
Sure.
The guy who works for KPMG is working for a profit-driven business. Who, of course, it's egregious and disgusting for us to ever have to deal with someone who's corrupt and engaged in a corrupt activity, whether in the private sector or public. But it is that much worse when it's someone who has the public's interests that they're supposed to be representing.
Absolutely,
and particularly the interests of the poor,
and also the cost to the state. If you look at the figures that I put out in the book for the cost of corruption, when Kenneth Brown was made chief procurement officer. In about 2013, he estimated that corruption in the supply chain was costing the government about 5% of all its goods and services budget. By the time he left, about 3 years later, when he had a staff of 100 people, he estimated that corruption was consuming about 40% of the state's goods and expenditure budget, which goods and services budget, which adds up to about 180 billion rand a year. That's equivalent to our health budget. It would be enough to cover our debt servicing costs for a year, and it would cover the revenue shortfall that we had last year. It would recover it six times over. So this is what it's costing us. Never mind the whole the destruction to the social fabric and the trust between state and society that's happened as a result, which is an unquantifiable cost.
What do you think of Piketty? I often see people on the left who oppose the free market and like to attack the KPMGs, and they run this Marxist trope of, well, the state needs to take control because these corporations are you know, these grossly unequal hegemonies who just exploit people and exploit workers. And what we need is more government, and we need more trade unions, and we need to use Piketty as our guide. What do you make of that?
So Piketty is highly relevant to South Africa because his conclusion was that capitalist societies, when they're left to their own devices, will become more and more unequal. Mm-hmm. And that's simply because the rich get richer and the poor never catch up.
Which I always say is the purpose of being alive, is to make yourself as unequal as possible.
Be that as it may.
Even if it's just in terms of your individual expression of who you are. Surely that is a purpose. So we don't have to have this debate now. I don't want to have a an economic philosophy discussion. But isn't the point to be as unequal as possible, whether it's posting pictures of your holiday in Bali when everyone else just goes to Mauritius, or if it's because you think that you have a nicer kitchen tray than someone else? The point is to be unequal. Humans are happiest when they're unequal to those that they are closest to.
Well, that's a scarily cynical view of the world.
I don't know. I think there may be merit in it, but nonetheless,
Piketty says trickle down
rampant capitalism
will left its own devices will keep reproducing the inherited patterns of wealth from the past.
Cool.
And that is obviously true in South Africa, because if your parents are poor, there is a 90% chance that you will be poor in South Africa. So yes, Piketty was right. The problem that we have in South Africa is that Piketty said, because of this, we should have wealth taxes of about 80% to redress the situation. That is what he would advocate. And for South Africa, he would advocate wealth taxes as a permanent sort of land reform.
But surely people like Piketty don't understand that the people who have enormous wealth have already taken it away. We've got capital flight. It's a major thing in this country.
Yeah, but just to finish the point, the problem with any tax in this country is that the money then goes to the state, which then has to spend it. And big
we'll,
point.
We'll bail out SAA and Eskom and SABC, and it won't go to the poor.
So even if it did, even if the money found its way into fiscal spending on education, there is such a tenuous link between government spending and an improvement in social outcomes in this country. The quality of the spending is so weak that they can't convert that education into upward mobility and opportunity for the poor child. So that is the problem. If you increase the tax, it doesn't produce a kid who can break out of poverty. So that's where the whole idea of the wealth tax flounders. If your government can't turn wealth into well-being, if it can't turn education into upward mobility, that wealth tax will make no difference the next day.
Well, it's like the this ongoing discussion around free tertiary education. You also tackle that in your book.
Yeah. So that is a similar sort of thing. We have this idea that free education will solve all our problems. And the book's got a graph in it which shows that only 5% of the poor qualify for university and get into university, but 50% of the affluent and the rich qualify for university and get into university. And that, again, comes down to the dysfunctional educational system. So if you provide free education for all those Model C kids, those kids of the elite, they can have free rides. Suddenly, that education is free. The funds that used to be collected from them that was used to cross-subsidize the poor, that's gone. Mm-hmm. So the affluent and the wealthy get a free ride. The same patterns get reproduced because your school system is dysfunctional. So 5% of the poor still get in, 50% of the rich get in. Only now it's free for the rich. So, you know, where is the logic in making education free for all?
It's like a compound interest on wealth.
It should be free for the poor. Mm. So, you know, these slogans sound so revolutionary, free education for all. It's regressive. Mm. And as long as those participation rates stay like that, 5% of the poor getting into university, you just perpetuate that inequality. It comes back again to fixing basic education. And so much of this book was supposed to be a book about the fiscal cliff. is a book about fixing education. And it's the unavoidable conclusion of the book that it is the central source of inequality in this country, and it's a cap on growth and our growth potential, because unless we can generate the engineers and the scientists and the high-level skills our economy needs, our growth rate is permanently capped. That is, I think, one of the things I would highlight that comes out of the book. It's an unavoidable conclusion. We have to fix the education system. And it's a long project. I know that's probably your next point. That's a 20-year intergenerational project. It is. But there's something you can do in the short term, and all countries do it. They import scarce skills. It's, according to Ricardo Hausmann, the quickest $500 bill lying on the floor for South Africa, because study after study has shown that if you import scarce skills, they increase wages and increase jobs for locals.
And, of course, they can be shared. Those skills can be transferred in some way, shape or form.
So every Home Affairs minister we've ever had has said yes to skilled immigration and never implemented it.
And it's so difficult for skilled people to get into this country and actually work.
And why would they even want to come, in given the current situation? So we just go around in circles in this country, and things never get better, and there's intense frustration.
Is there a way that technology can help propel us forward and up?
Yeah. We can leapfrog to some extent. A lot of the new technology can be harnessed in a way that can allow us to short-circuit years and years of formal training. It costs about R1 million to train a tools maker up to international standards in South Africa. Mm-hmm. R1 million per person. We can only afford to train a couple of thousand people to be tool makers. Mm-hmm. But if we used virtual reality, augmented reality, to combine with the formal training, so you would only train the person up to a certain level, and after that, they would be working with robotic technology, robot doing half the work, the person doing the other half. You can leapfrog years of formal training. So although the fear is that robots are the enemy and robots are going to steal all our jobs, there's this opportunity to use robots to allow humans to work more efficiently. And in South Africa's case, it could actually help us if we realize that and we're not too afraid to embrace it.
I like to be optimistic, but you have to also be realistic.
Sure.
And sometimes you need to look at what the possible worst outcome might be. Let's imagine that we know that SARS is having trouble raising tax income for government like they used to, because they're not as competent as they used to be, and because the economy is not growing.
And because tax morality is declining, because people have less willingness to depart mm-hmm. with their cash.
Yeah, correct. I mean, you don't mind contributing to a society that's improving. You have a problem when you see pilfering and wastage and corruption everywhere. So imagine we get to the stage where we owe more than we can possibly recoup. Then we rush to the arms of the IMF. How bad is that scenario, and what does it mean for our future?
So the IMF estimates that we are 5 years away from that situation. They say if the economy grows at 1%, or all SOEs call in their contingency the liabilities with government, those guarantees, if that happens, we will be sitting at a 70% debt to GDP ratio in 5 years, and that is a level of debt distress which in other emerging market economies has been associated with default and going to the IMF for a bailout. So we could be 5 years away from that if our economy doesn't grow and if we don't fix our SOEs.
What does that mean for us?
So we can access from the IMF, because we contribute to the IMF, we can access about 140 billion rands worth of bailout funding from the IMF, which is actually not that much money. If we're losing 180 billion a year to corruption, 140 billion is not huge. It'll keep us going for maybe a year. Mm. The IMF doesn't part with its cash without putting in place a economic program for the country that the country has to buy into and agree to. It's got monitoring, it's got targets. And if you stick to your program and you do what the IMF suggests, so it's conditional. The cash is conditional. It comes with strings attached, and the strings from the IMF will be things like reducing the headcount in the public service. It will be things like liberalizing the labor market, making it easier to hire and fire, It will involve things like reducing...
I'm almost willing to invite them in right
exactly.
now.
Exactly. So the best thing that could happen would be an IMF bailout, because it would force us to make those politically tough trade-offs that we've refused to make until now. It wouldn't give us the option. You'd make these changes. This is the stuff you should have been doing, and you haven't done it, so now we're going
to help you. We don't have to wait 5 years.
Yeah. So it's the stuff we should have been doing anyway. Right. Okay. So it's not like the IMF is some massive bully in the sky.
That's going to force us into what the Greeks had to do with austerity.
Sure, there will be some austerity, but the IMF has actually said to us a few years ago, if you approach your fiscal problems with too much austerity, if you tighten too fast, too quickly, if you raise taxes too high, too quickly, it will be self-defeating. So do it slowly, spread it over several years. This is the IMF telling us to slow down on the austerity. So this old idea we have of the IMF being all about, you know, crushing economies and forcing you into a straitjacket is actually, it's a bit of a myth. So anyway, if we went with the IMF, we'd have to stick to this program. And if we did that, we'd get the cash. Because of our ideological attachments, there's going to be a clear reluctance for the government to do that. They will probably look to the BRICS. They will look east. They will look to China, where they have exactly the same arrangement. So we're entitled to about 130 billion from the contingency reserve arrangement we have with the BRICS bank. So it's a tiny bit less than we'd get from the IMF, but we have access to that money because of the contribution we've made. So we go to the BRICS bank thinking, well, the Chinese won't attach the same strings because the BRICS institutions were set up.
But of course they will.
They were set up to counteract Western hegemony.
Because they don't want to be lumped with our debt.
When you look into it a little bit, you find that the BRICS bank regulations say we'll give you 30% of that 130 billion without strings. But if you want the other 70%, you have to have an IMF structural adjustment policy in place, and you have to be meeting your targets.
So it's even more draconian.
It's a cul-de-sac. We go to China thinking, wow, we're on good terms with the Chinese. They'll understand us. They're an emerging market. And they say, oh, by the way, go straight back to the IMF. I mean, it's ironic. I was stunned when I found that out. And
extremely
I wonder if
short-sighted.
The government even realizes it.
All right. why don't we just sell whatever's left of these state-owned enterprises? Why don't we just let them be privatized?
Yeah, so that I say that in the book. I say just sell the bloody things because
I mean, the SABC, other than being a propaganda vehicle for whichever political party is in the majority, whichever political party can have more people on the board, other than that, it is not a going concern. It can't even make enough money to exist year after year. SAA, same thing. Mm. Let the other airlines come in and pick up the slack.
Absolutely. So I'm all in favor. If you look at what Manuel did in 94 when he came in as finance minister, one of the reasons why he was able to get on top of our debt situation was through privatization. And the numbers are in the book, how much was raised through privatization. The money that was raised was used to pay down debt. Manuel halved our debt
right.
in 10
Absolutely.
Years.
Absolutely, because the ANC inherited a government that was in big trouble.
Yeah,
he inherited
very dangerous debt dynamics.
Yeah.
And he did a couple of
what
things.
What did he sell?
I think, I mean, I actually can't even remember what he sold. I think ISCOR was privatized.
ISCOR was a big
That's
one.
That's the
yeah.
one I can remember. But the point is that we're in a real cash crunch, and I explain how fiscally constrained we are as a country, and I don't think that penny has dropped, because if it had, the government wouldn't be talking about still implementing nuclear, and it wouldn't still be talking about implementing national health insurance. There is no money to pursue new policies without hiking taxes dramatically. And of course, the moment you do that, you have it just means your growth is affected. So it's self-defeating. We can't raise taxes without hurting growth more. We can't really cut expenditure much because there's so little room in the budget because of high wages and all the social spending. So if you cut spending, you have an adverse effect on delivery. If you have an adverse effect on unemployment because suddenly all these public servants are unemployed, which then feeds back into lower consumption, lower demand, lower growth. There's no fiscal ammunition to stimulate the economy. And you can't get rid of corruption as long as Zuma and his cronies are in power.
Mm-hmm.
So we are so backed into a corner fiscally. There is one thing left in the fiscal cupboard that hasn't been used, and that's that, a VAT increase. And we know that a VAT increase hurts the poor the most. It would be the least damaging to the economy, but it would have to be countered in some way by pro-poor measures to prevent a welfare impact on the poor. So it's a political suicide for whichever party implements a VAT increase. Can't do it in going into a general election. So that's in the cupboard, but the door is closed. And it's supposed to be used to finance NHI, National Health Insurance, when it finally kicks in. It's been kept in reserve.
Another thing that we know the government will be about as good at running as they are at the SOEs.
Yeah. So one health economist once said that NHI was like leaving a brand spanking BMW parked in Hillbrow with the window rolled down and the keys in the ignition. And I've never heard a better explanation of what NHI would be in South Africa than that.
Look, I could talk to you all morning, but you've got other things to do and people to see and places to go. And congratulations again on this book. It's terrific. I think everybody who has an interest, and even those people who don't know that they have an interest in the economy, should be reading it.
Thanks, Gareth, and very generous of you. Thank you.
No, it's excellent. So there it is, called On the Brink, South Africa's Political and Fiscal Cliffhanger. And it's by Claire Bissaker, and it includes a chapter by Rob Rose and some by Dennis Davis as well. Congratulations, it's a terrific book, and you should read it. It's a nice stocking stuffer for Christmas. Just put someone in the household in a depressed and miserable mood for the festive season. Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Gareth.
This is CliffCentral.com.